Hello, everybody. Well, I'm gonna start going in a moment. Are you ready or not? Right, so hello everybody. So my name's Rhys Morgan, and I'm from the university's research office, particularly specifically the research strategy office, where I'm the head of research policy, governance and integrity. And I've been asked to give a brief introduction to research integrity, research misconduct, the sorts of things that my team deals with. I've got about half an hour. I'm hoping I'll take a little bit less so there's any questions at the end. But before I start, really, if there's only one thing that you take away from this session, please take away that I exist and that my team exists. Because what we're here for, among other things, is to be a source of advice and support for anyone who has questions about any of the issues I'm going to talk about in the short talk today. And all the advice that we provide is confidential. And if there are problems, we can offer support, particularly if it's something that you don't feel comfortable bringing up at a local level. We can provide support centrally for you, or we can direct you to other support, either within the university or externally. And I'll talk a little bit about that as the session goes on. But yes, if you need us, we are there. So I'm going to talk about two specific things today. I'm going to talk about, firstly, about the research misconduct and what we mean by it and what the university's expectations are, and then about research integrity as well. So the sorts of things that we expect researchers to be considering in their work, the sorts of things that I kind of worry about in my day-to-day. So let's start off with some discussion of research misconduct. So this is taken from Universities UK's Concordat to Support Research Integrity, which is the central document that sets guidance for researchers and what should be expected in good research practice. And it defines research misconduct as behavior or actions that fall short of the standards of ethics, research, and scholarship required to ensure that the integrity of research is upheld. That's all very nice and a kind of good high-level definition, but it doesn't really tell you the sorts of things are included under that definition. So, can you give me any suggestions of what we might be talking about here? What sort of things might the UK want us to avoid? Yes. Falsifying data. Excellent. Thank you. Anything else? Plagiarism. Lovely. Well, not lovely. Anything else? Misappropriating data, so yeah, taking data that's not yours or using it when you don't have permission. Absolutely. Great, thank you. And so these are all exactly the sorts of things that we're talking about here. So this is the university's definition of research misconduct. It starts off with what we tend to call FFP, so fabrication, falsification, and plagiarism. I'll talk about those in a bit more detail in a second. And that's in proposing research, carrying out research, or reporting the results of research. So this can be in grant applications, this can be in your day-to-day in the lab, and it can be in putting out papers or in PhD theses. If we were in the United States, normally that would be where we'd stop. They have a very specific and quite restricted definition of research misconduct. The UK definition is wider. So we tend to include in that deliberate, dangerous, or negligent deviations from accepted practice in carrying out research. So this might be if you're using personal data and you misuse it by not putting protections in place or by sharing it to people that you shouldn't. Or if you're working with human participants, placing them in danger without appropriate safeguards, or in other ways, putting them at risk. Those all might be considered dangerous or negligent deviations. And then we have misrepresentation. So this might be misrepresenting data, so presenting it as something that isn't, misrepresenting your involvement. So saying that you contributed to a paper when you didn't, or saying that somebody didn't contribute to a paper when they did. And that links into authorship issues. Also applies to qualifications or experience, so lying about qualifications, and failure to declare competing interests. So if you're funded by a particular company and that has an influence on your research, or they might have an interest in your research, such as, you know, research involving obesity and you're funded by Coca-Cola, then that's something that should be declared. So those sorts of things come under the definition. And then finally, a kind of catch-all of failure to meet ethical, legal, and professional obligations. This might be Human Tissue Act, it might be General Data Protection Regulation, etc. What's really important about the university's definition is common across most universities is that we do not include in our definition honest error. So it's not about catching people who've made mistakes or honest differences in interpretation or judgment. So it's not getting into whether somebody's research is right or wrong, or, you know, whether somebody's made a misjudgment in how they're interpreting the data. This is about specific intentional misconduct or poor practice. And so if any of those sorts of things happen, but, you know, very clearly an error, then it might not come under the definition. So I'm just going to dig down very briefly into FFP and what we exactly mean by that. So hopefully this one will be obvious to everybody in the room. Plagiarism, the university has its own definition of what it considers to be plagiarism, which is up on the screen there. So quoting verbatim or paraphrasing work without acknowledgement, using someone's ideas without permission, cutting and pasting from multiple sources, usually online, or submitting someone else's work as if it were your own. All of those things can be plagiarism. I mean, as I'm sure you've been told, you know, multiple times in your academic career thus far. Perhaps something that you've looked at less so far are issues of fabrication and falsification. So fabrication, effectively making stuff up. So this might be inventing research data or results. So let's say you fail to do an experiment and you panic about it and you fake all the data to cover it up. So that would be fabrication. Claiming the data represents something that doesn't. So issues that often come up, you know, in cases internationally are taking images from previous experiments and saying that they represent something from a current experiment. So that can also be considered to be fabrication. Or fixing experiments to get the correct results. So, you know, substituting samples, manipulating equipment so that you get the results that you're after. All of those things would be considered fabrication. And while these are all, you know, a lot of these sound outlandish, if you look into international news, you know, there are cases of this happening internationally in science with some regularity. And then we have issues of falsification. So falsification is slightly different. So this is where you've got something, but you manipulate it or change it to get the result or the answer that you want. So this might be adjusting research data by and removing unwanted data points about a good reason, photoshopping images in microscopy or things like that, or covering up data that you don't want. So tampering up some metadata or records to pretend that something didn't happen because it undermines your hypothesis or the results that you're after. All of these would be considered falsification. So as I've said, these things do hit the news every so often. So this is a major case from some time ago now, a case of Hwang Woo-suk, who is a scientist in South Korea, a very major figure in South Korean science, involved in human somatic cell cloning. He was the first person to clone a dog, which was legitimate research. He hit the news first because one of his collaborators asked to have his name removed from a paper because he had concerns about egg donations used in the research and whether there'd been proper informed consent. Mm-hmm. And this triggered an investigation into Hwang Woo-suk's work and found that one of his major papers into human somatic cell cloning had been fabricated. It also proved the fact that there had been inadequate informed consent on the egg donations. There had been pressure put on people to donate eggs to the research. And this ultimately resulted in a 2-year prison sentence because of the bioethics regulation breaches, as well as the loss of his job, loss of reputation, etc. So really serious consequences for a really serious case. But these things are quite rare, these big cases, you'll see one or two a year across the world where a major scientist is found guilty of doing something really quite seriously bad. But it's not just the big things that can have serious implications. And often, you know, it's the little things that we need to worry about. So this again is another example. This is an example from the UK of an individual called Malcolm Pierce, who was found to have fabricated a research study about ectopic pregnancy. But it's not actually Malcolm Pierce that I want to focus on. It's on one of his co-authors, Geoffrey Chamberlain. So Chamberlain was a major figure in the gynecological research community. He was an editor of a major journal. He was a president of a Royal Society. And he was one of the co-authors on the paper. But he hadn't actually been involved in the research at all. So he was approached by Pierce, who knew him from, they would share the same university, and said, you know, I want to put your name on the paper. You're the major figure in the field. I want you involved. It'll be great for you. It's a major discovery. You can put your name on the paper. And Chamberlain accepted having his name put on the paper. So Chamberlain committed a much lesser act of poor judgment, poor research integrity. But when the story hit the newspapers, it was Geoffrey Chamberlain's face all over the newspapers because he was the major figure on the paper. The investigation found out he had no knowledge of the fabrication because he had very little knowledge of the paper at all. But it led to resignation as editor and president, you know, huge impacts on his career. So these little things can have quite big repercussions. So as I've indicated, serious research misconduct, quite rare. So one study estimated that there were probably about 40 investigations into quite serious issues in the UK. And of course, not all of those resulted in findings. Increasingly, the data is improving on that. And I'm hoping actually that we'll get some proper data from the new UK Research Integrity Committee that UKRI have set up, which will perhaps provide more insight into that. This sort of low-level stuff is probably more common. Again, there have been studies from the early 2000s. Finelli's first study in 2009 using US data found that 2% of scientists, when given complete confidentiality, would admit to fabricating, falsifying, or modifying data, and 14% said that they were aware of a colleague who'd done it. A similar study in the BMJ for UK data found similar sorts of statistics. Finelli has followed this up much more recently with a paper looking specifically at plagiarism, and the percentage for that is actually slightly higher. So these things are happening. Again, it's not on a massive scale, but it is happening in universities across the UK and the world. So a lot of these issues are not because somebody's gone into it wanting to commit fraud, wanting to do something wrong, wanting to get ahead through cheating. More often, and one of the things that I do in my job is I provide administrative support to investigations within the university into allegations of research misconduct. What's behind a lot of these issues are actually more likely to be bad habits, people taking bad decisions when they're under pressure, or culture within a research team or within a group leading to bad behaviors. And so it's not people intentionally doing things, but other kind of habits and bad decisions leading to problems. And this can be caused by a range of things. And if we want to avoid them, if we want to avoid ending up in a situation where you might have to make a decision around research integrity and you might end up making the wrong decision, then we need to start thinking about what are the cultural drivers, what are the things that encourage people to do the wrong thing or put them in a situation where they might have to decide whether to do the wrong thing. And some of you I'll be doing kind of more in-depth sessions with as part of your course, where we'll dig into this in a bit more detail. But I'm going to give a kind of oversight of my view on it anyway, and maybe at the end, if there's any questions, we can talk about specific things in more detail. So partly it's about perverse incentives. So the academic system is set up to try and get as many papers out as possible, to get into the top journals, to get onto the next job. And these things can encourage people to try and, you know, cut corners, to try and go for, you know, the flashy, the eye-catching, to try and get into the top papers and things like that. These are things that the university, in its role in the sector, is trying to help tackle through things such as the Declaration on Research Assessment, which is looking at how we assess researchers in terms of promotion and things like that. But they, we are aware that they are still out there, that people do feel that kind of push to get up into the top journals, and sometimes cutting corners can be the result of that. Issues of lack of oversight. So a lot of the cases that we see in the university are where individuals have got isolated. So they're no longer getting support, they maybe aren't talking to people, they are maybe working odd hours, and so they're not seeing the rest of their team. And in those sorts of situations, small problems can kind of metastasize and become big problems. And so one of the things that I would heavily encourage everyone to do, and I'll talk about this a little more in a minute, is try to build up kind of support networks, people who you can go to talk to if one day one of your studies goes horribly wrong and you think, oh God, this is awful. So you're not stuck there on your own trying to make a decision that could end up with you thinking, oh, well, if I should remove that data point, my problem kind of goes away. So getting that level of support is really important. Pressure. Now, pressure, of course, comes from all sorts of areas. Sometimes it's senior people pressurizing. Sometimes it's us, as we're working, pressurizing ourselves. And so thinking about how you can handle that pressure at an early stage is something that can help avoid those situations coming further down the track. And then finally, this issue of fear, the idea that I kind of already touched on of this has gone wrong, oh God, you know, this is a really bad problem. And that's what we can help with. So if somebody is in a situation where they feel they haven't got any choices or they don't know what to do and you're panicking, then do come and talk to us, because we can help in those sorts of situations, try and get you some support, give you some advice, and help with those situations so that people don't make the wrong decisions. So, talked a bit about why it happens. It's also important, of course, to think about why we want to avoid it. What are the impacts of these sorts of things on the research community? So, as I'm sure you'll be aware, you know, the impact of bad research, of problematic research, could very quickly escalate. So research is built on research, and if one piece is rotten, then things build on top of it. So there's a very good set of stories in Physics World, which is a kind of physics-based kind of popular journal, about a particular research misconduct case, a guy called Jan Hendrik Schön, who was a physics researcher who fabricated a large amount of his work. And it follows all the PhD students who were trying to replicate his studies, and they couldn't. Why is it not working? And in interviews that they say, I was hitting my head against the desk, and this is so awful. This, it's just been shown in the literature that this worked, and I couldn't get it to work because it had never worked. Sean had invented it, or it had all been made up. And so the kind of scholarly impacts of these things can be enormous and can have really kind of unexpected impacts further down the line. Was there a financial impact, wasted research funding, both research that funding that the person who does the wrong thing has, but also later studies as well? Impact on public, particularly public perceptions of research and researchers. So researchers remain among the most trusted professions in the country, but of course these sorts of cases kind of do hammer away at that. And it's something that, particularly if we want to make a case for more funding for research, more support for research, it's something that we need to avoid. And finally, as I've kind of indicated already, there are serious personal implications for anyone who commits research misconduct. And that can range from just the bad time that one goes through if you're an investigator for research misconduct, all the way through to kind of loss of career, etc., depending on the seriousness of the incident. So we need to try and avoid these things, and these are kind of just my initial tips. So obviously being aware of these things is really important, and trying to avoid them. But as I've said, networks of practice, advice, support Oxygen can, you know, is the best way of avoiding these sorts of things.
Sharing data.
Sharing responsibilities as well. So if people in a group have individual responsibilities, making sure that there's people they can go to help. If you don't have a specific responsibility that only you're responsible for, try and find people who can advise and help you most. And if you can't help in any of your places, go and seek it, and we're out there to help you if need be. If in the worst case scenario, there's an actual case of research misconduct and you're worried about that somebody's doing the wrong thing, the university does have a policy that's up on the website, and I can advise on how people can activate that policy if necessary. So in the last 5 or 10 minutes, I've got my 5 minutes left. I'm just going to give a brief overview of the other side of the equation, which is research integrity. So we worry about research integrity for many reasons. So we want to make sure that our published findings are trustworthy. So we want to put out stuff that if someone picks it up and says, this is a paper from the University of Cambridge, I can trust that. And in order for it to be trusted, the process behind it needs to be trustworthy, it needs to be rigorous. The people who created it have to be trustworthy, they have to be honest. And the way it's presented needs to be trustworthy, it has to be transparent and open. And integrity is then also about the relationships that we have with others in the university. So care, respect for participants, honestly presenting to others, and presenting other people's contributions openly. And of course, integrity helps when things go wrong. So what we want is people to be able to show that they've gone through the best practice, that they've presented things properly, that they've been rigorous in their methods, so that if there is an issue, we can point to those and say, actually, no, we have done the right thing here. So all of this information is you know, brought together in the Research Integrity Concordat that sets out the expectations for universities and for researchers, and gives this definition of research integrity. What do we have to do? We have to be honest, rigorous, transparent, caring, and accountable. And so that splits responsibility across the university, who have to provide training and guidance, support and advice, ethical review, misconduct investigations when necessary, making sure our policies are up to date, and trying to build cultures of integrity. So making sure that, you know, if people need help, if they need support, that support is there. And then the researchers themselves need to take personal responsibility for their integrity, understand the expected standards, comply with the ethical obligations, declare any conflicts of interest, and try and embed integrity in everything that we do. So finally, in terms of support that's out there, this training session leads into wider training sessions, and I can help you kind of identify those if you need them. We can offer advice and support when things go wrong. And if anyone has any ideas of things they want to do locally in terms of supporting best practice, we'd be very interested in supporting that as well. I'm not going to go through this in detail, but hopefully the slides will be circulated. We have lots of things on the website that sum up a lot of this stuff. We have an integrity statement, we have good research practice guidelines, and a general kind of integrity website that has all of these things all there. And that is everything that I wanted to say this afternoon, unless there are any questions.
Thank you, Rhys. So it's always a fascinating topic, so there must be some questions.
So it does vary, but it probably varies between 5 and 10 things go to an investigation in a year. Now, a lot of those do end up being, you know, something that is actually more minor, there isn't a banned case. But yeah, there is a regular kind of churn of these sorts of things going on in the background. And that will be the same at most universities of our size. In fact, we publish data on this sort of thing. We have to. It's all about, you know, transparency, and so we put a number of cases up on a report on our website.
I was in
Yes, so we do have various things. So I do offer a course on academic research and personal data use. And my understanding is there is also training more generically from the information compliance team. There we go. Excellent. So yeah, so there's various sources depending on what sort of thing you need, really. Yeah. It's all like that.
Any more questions?
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much,
cool.
Reese.
Thank you.